You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit, the show dedicated to exploring the ideas, concepts and contexts underpinning the art of contemporary, underpinning the work of contemporary artists. I managed to almost get that out. It always scuppers me every week. But my guest this evening is an artist who creates complex polyphonic narratives by combining, translating and intermixing cultural material from around the world. A painter, filmmaker, sculptor, installation artist, scriptwriter and curator, Shahzad Dawood is a post-postmodern Renaissance man, part trickster and part mage. He says of his own activity, "I suppose what I try to do is play with varying elements to reflect the absurdity and hidden meanings in the structure of the world as perceived construct, in order to attempt a kind of Brechtian wake-up call, or at least have some fun while doing it." Shahzad, welcome to the Studio Visit studio.
Thanks, Morgan. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you for braving the cold weather today. It's not still icy in the streets, isn't it?
It's not as bad as a couple of days ago.
No.
It's nice to get out.
Now, I'm not sure if you've read your own Wikipedia profile. Did you even know
daily,
that you have one?
Daily.
But it suggests that your interest in combining culture stems from your mixed cultural heritage. Is that where you trace it from?
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because people always want to kind of, you know, try and compartmentalize you in a nice soundbite. And I guess half of what I do each day is to try and escape that very compartmentalization. Mm. So, you know, I'm sure kind of growing up between different language structures, belief structures. And I mean, I was very fortunate. I mean, I grew up in southwest suburban London, I guess in the late 70s and 80s. And it was just great around my dad's house. You know, we lived in this kind of quite dull suburban street. It was, apart from the adopted girl next door, we were the only non-white people on the street. You know, it was very kind of, you know, mighty white, you know, that old bread you used to get, mighty white. It was very, you know, white bread. And, you know, everyone went to church on Sunday. Everyone was in the neighbourhood watch scheme, except my dad, who was this sort of curmudgeonly, you know, Asian geezer who would have nothing to do with it. And, you know, you know, my dad, I don't know if you know, he was a music photographer in the States in the 60s. So he was on stage at Woodstock, and I grew up kind
That's
of...
interesting.
I grew up knowing kind of some of the members of the Aeroplane, Jefferson Aeroplane.
No.
Are still friends of his today.
Wow.
You know, I think, was it 2005 was the last time I went with my dad to kind of hook up with them on tour and
Wow, that's
out.
Really interesting.
So maybe that sheds some more light, because, you know, I think sometimes people want me to, you know, my dad to have had a sort of prayer cap and run the local corner shop, and it's just like, that's your kind of, you know, preconception, not mine, honey.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mum was a psychologist and very interested in kind of different esoteric or spiritual schools. Mm. So, you know, it was a pretty interesting mélange of stuff to grow up with.
So it sounds like a coffee table that had both Rolling Stone and, I don't know, Freud's compendium.
And Nusrat Fateh Khan. You know, it was very rich in that way. Mm, mm. So I think you could say that maybe my experience or my knowledge base was wider because of all those different things coming in.
Mm, mm.
But I think I'd almost kind of put a challenge out, you know, with putting the shoe on the other foot, and just say, I'm so surprised by how unenlarged some people's worldview is.
Right.
The fact that, you know, you just look in your own backyard is still fairly standard practice is kind of actually rather disgusting in terms of human evolution, if that isn't too strong a point to make.
Well, no. We should start strong. Why not? Now, you studied critical fine art practice at St. Martin's as an undergrad.
Yeah.
And it sounded to me, that sounds like a very particular degree. I mean, when I think of young artists leaving foundation, not really knowing what they're doing, they kind of just stumble into fine art and try and feel their way around the practice. But critical fine art, it sounds very specific. So what made you choose it at the time?
I think it, you know, I'd... I'd been tempted to both study theatre design. I was really interested in set design, something about the kind of nature of artifice that went in that maybe still feeds into, you know, some of the aspects of trickster I bring to play in the work and in the way it's configured across different sites and locations. So, you know, I'd foregone theatre design, and I'd also, I was very interested in continental philosophy and possibly from, you know, my mother's influence, I'm not sure. So critical, you know, I just didn't want to kind of, you know, pussy about and make marks on a paper without really getting to grips and really arguing out why I should be doing it. And, you know, critical fine art practice was a really kind of experimental course set up by Monica Ross and Anne Talentire, both sort of fantastic artists and educators. And, you know, it was really dense and rigorous. I mean, often at St. Martin's, a lot of the, you know, more standard painting and sculpture, you still had those pathways then, you know, would go, what do you guys do? You just sit around reading these really complex books. You know, we'd sit around reading kind of Lucy Rigore or the Horkheimer, you know, and, you know, maybe make some work come Friday. but when we made work, we really...
and you knew what it was about. And you could, so, because a lot of the times when people talk about theory, critical theory, let's say, or even philosophy, there's the idea that somehow it sort of straitjackets their practice, or it pushes them towards a deadlock. They get too involved in the text. But it really feels to me like you have it's a reciprocal relationship between what you're making and what you're thinking about. Well, it's praxis, basically. But it's praxis actually happening.
Become the text.
So what sort of work were you making at the time? I mean, we talked about that's what I'm... I mean, you know, what sort of work? Were you painting? Were you...
I was making quite a lot of kind of hand-cut video work and painting and making photography, and I guess it was all over the shop. I mean, it took me a long time, even after leaving college, to... I think there was just so much going on in my head to try and kind of narrow it down. You know, some people might argue that I still don't do that very effectively, but, you know, to kind of narrow it down to kind of... so that at least there was some sort of loose through line through it. Took me a while. So I was all over the place. I was making everything from sort of, you know, darkly angsty video works, you know, killing my friends and my girlfriend, and, you know, to making kind of weird paintings, kind of exploring my sexuality, and then doing kind of other things that are perhaps even more embarrassing. But, you know, there was some... I think what it was for me, I really used it. I think maybe one of the problems you have with art education today is everyone is trying to make a product too soon. Mm. You know, one of the things about that course was there was the freedom to read, to think, and to really experiment. You know, I really wasn't... I guess also I was lucky enough to be at college at a time when, you know, being an artist was not a vocation yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was a loser in many people's eyes, particularly for my family. You know, oh, well, what a waste of potential. and so, but that was a wonderful freedom because, you know, I had nothing to lose.
Yeah.
So you could, you know, I was just really trying stuff out. And I always had this kind of passion for getting people involved. So I'd always be running into some department or actually it was great being in St. Martin's on Charing Cross Road because I'd walk into model agencies and sort of somehow bullshit them that I was a trainee fashion photographer. And could they give me some models for a shoot and then be enacting these weird performances, you know, in my studio in St. Martin in the college with all these kind of quite glamorous looking people, you know. And I just, you know, it's just, I guess for me, there's always been that excitement about the world. Mm. The world is a wonderfully rich, exciting place every day.
Okay, well, we're going to travel somewhere else in the world, to Jamaica, I think. Did you like that link there?
Very, very deftly kind of inserted.
So can you just introduce the track that we're listening to at the moment?
I believe we're starting with Best Dressed Chicken in Town by Dr. Alimentado. This is just great. This is, you know, coming out of a classic period of some amazing producers working out of Jamaica. I'll let you get on with the track. Enjoy.
I call the best, the best, the best, the best.
Shezad, so I wanted to ask you about some of your early work, and I sort of heard it described as a process of cultural translation, and this is something I can see definitely in early projects like Arcadia, and I think what was collected underneath the title of the Billboards project. Mm. Can you talk a bit about, you know, what was happening there? Was this a Brechtian wake-up call, or was this you having fun?
It was trying to kind of work my way through sort of my ideas, trying to find out, to get to the point of, you know, maybe a greater formation. I guess artists are always trying to kind of push towards the sort of next, you know, awakening. So maybe it was a sort of personal working through and a series of kind of wake-up calls to myself. So I think with some of that early work, there was a more kind of binary working out of kind of self and other, you know, my own self performing in some of the work and not in other works. But this, and very much an idea of the body, I think, you know, connected to notions around performance as well as painting and the image in circulation, you know, which have, I think, become increasingly sophisticated and nuanced and maybe more subtle as the work has come on. So maybe, you know, even what I was saying about what I was doing on my degree, even though some of that stuff was being made onto my sort of MA and further on, it still felt like, you know, almost like I was still kind of going through my apprenticeship.
And so it's a Billboards project. Is the project where you were kind of reimagining or translating sort of iconic films of the 20th century, so like Taxi Driver. Is this, Taxi Driver, and my personal favourite is The Empire Strikes Back, and they're kind of recast in, I suppose, like for sort of Indian audiences, or could you talk a bit about the process that led up to these works? Or
yeah, I think, to be honest, I wasn't really considering an Indian or Pakistani audience. I was actually considering a Western audience that almost, you know, at the time, I felt unthinkingly exported its culture or assumed dominance. You know, so I think it's not maybe the imperialist politics of old, but it's a more subtle, what's, you know, quite often, you know, we commonly now call cultural imperialism. Mm. But I think it's more subtle social codes, you know. And what particularly interests me, say, with Taxi Driver, for example, is that, you know, in a Euro-American diaspora, because don't forget, we're all diasporas.
Yeah.
you know, one says Taxi Driver, and do you think of a guy who actually drives a cab or Robert De Niro? It's pretty close. You know, it's become that ubiquitous, the De Niro film. Even people who have possibly haven't seen it kind of know what you're referring to.
Yeah.
You know, in that way in which we're in a kind of ever increasingly self-referential culture where if you haven't seen Soylent Green, but you'll still know it from Wikipedia and its caricature on The Simpsons.
Mm.
You know, so you've got this, you know, you're picking up, you know, it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but through every form of media, which is, I think, exciting. But I was interested in the fact that a taxi driver is, you know, is somebody as a job performed by thousands, millions. I don't know quite, you know, I wouldn't begin to know how many people, but in cities and, you know, and towns all around the world.
Mm.
And so I was just interested to kind of invert that. So all of those sort of film poster paintings, I kind of loosely term that set, were, I wanted to kind of remake the film posters for Taxi Driver, for Empire Strikes Back.
Mm.
And I did a number of others, like Girl on a Motorcycle, you know, the Marianne Faithfull one from the 60s, and just reimagined them in, you know, so actually I was in Pakistan and I was just remaking the film posters, sort of photographing people or whatever. Mm. So for Taxi Driver, I went to the kind of seedy part of Karachi at like 2 a.m. and waited for the right cab driver who just, you know, to me was the kind of local De Niro, and got him to pose. And we just kind of restaged the kind of the two kind of iconic Taxi Driver film posters.
It really feels like what you're doing is opening up the world really to viewers, because it did make me think, well, yeah, actually it makes you question the idea of sort of cultural, Western cultural hegemony and how it kind of is infiltrated everywhere. I'm also wondering, was that because, you know, you're coming out, you're sort of around in what I call the death rattle of British monocultural, like cultural production, which is Britpop. And I wondered, was that also a factor in you questioning this sort of vocabulary or advertising vocabulary that was coming out, or this very strict identity that was being mapped out by advertisers and governments in Cool Britannia and things like that?
Absolutely. Mm. You know, and that's where I think since then the work has gone on to be more nuanced, more multiple, because I think, you know, I think one of the things we're living through at the moment is a very seismic shift in, you know, centers of power and their orbits. And therefore, suddenly it's all much more fluid and up for grabs. So perhaps I don't need to do that anymore.
Mm.
And that's quite a freedom. You know, you're right. I mean, there was a certain moment where, you know, there is that sort of death rattle of monoculture.
Yeah.
You know, you can still, there are still quite a lot of people who keep their head in the sand, quite surprisingly, you know, even in the arts field. But really, the reality is shifted and we all know it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's less need to sort of play to those, some of those. Maybe the syntax is less binary. It's, as I say, it's more fluid, more multiple.
And this sort of translation or juxtaposition of cultures recurs again in Blow Up. Could you talk a bit about that project? Because when I came to visit your studio the other day, which I should say to listeners is incredible, it's the most amazing studio I've ever seen. So organised, Suzanne. It is so organised.
I think I have to be organised to keep so many sort of strands and tangents kind of together.
Fair enough. But tell us about this project, because that was, did you go to Karachi for that as well?
Yeah, I went back to Karachi, and, you know, it was, I had this crazy idea to kind of stage a hoax remake of Antonioni's Blow Up in Karachi. And I was just interested in this way in which Blow Up itself is an act of translation, because you've got this Italian director making this iconic film, but actually, you know, at least the kind of one of the superficial themes is Swinging London or Swinging London of the 60s, which obviously to make a film about something, particularly by a foreign director, it's over. And so you've got this kind of ghost of, you know, you've got David Hemmings channeling the ghost of David Bailey, and you've got the Yardbirds kind of playing in the center of the film, which maybe we can come back to that. And I was interested in this act of translation, you know, the Italian director kind of articulating his perceived reading of Swinging London, you know, for a more international audience. Mm. And obviously there's an interesting politics around the image, which is at the central arc of the film. And I was quite interested in that relationship between the still and moving image that's I don't think as well articulated maybe in Peeping Tom, but really it's never quite done in that same way as it is in Blow Up. And so I had this crazy idea to kind of restage a remake of it, and I kind of like maybe, I mean, less so when I'm, you know, less so now as I'm getting a bit older. But when I was younger, I loved setting myself these crazy projects. I guess I still do. Mm. But, you know, the scale has grown up. So they just, you can't just go overnight. You know, I remember packing a suitcase and just going, moving to Karachi for a period of months. And just my self-set mission was to get invited to all the right parties to meet all the top models and actresses in town and somehow persuade them to be in this film. Mm. That was actually not going to happen. So it was kind of quite a, you know, it was like a sort of Challenge Annika kind of setup.
Well, it sounds like what you were, the same thing as what you were doing at St. Martin's, navigating these model agencies around Charing Cross Road. Or,
yeah,
and you're not talking about the model agencies. Anyway.
I mean, who's to know? I mean, that was one of the crazy things about the project is I end up in Karachi and get all the, you know, all these top models and actresses to be in this film. We find this ex-colonial film studio on the outskirts of Karachi and build a simulacrum of David Hemmings's photo studio from the film and get everyone there for the first day of shooting. And then I destroy the set the next morning and leave the country. And all I do is shoot a bunch of still film as the kind of vestige of or trace of this action. But what's interesting is the photographic studio in Blow Up is a white, you know, is a white Infinity studio. Mm-hmm. So as somebody once said to me, I think, you know, you sure you didn't just go and do it all in Southall? And maybe I did.
Now, your later work sort of changes a bit from this impulse of translation or of inserting different signs in the flow of sort of Western cultural icons. And it becomes this, how can I put it? It's this polyphemic improvisation, I guess, or this virtue. It's a kind of virtuosity in your work of navigating different language structures and histories and then putting them together to make these multi-themed works that are really, really dense. So we're going to play a song before we start to go in and talking about them. And basically, what this is a song by somebody else who is also celebrates kind of polythemes and polyrhythms. This is Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart with Muffin Man. Do you want to say anything about this track before we play it? Or
it's one of the greatest tracks ever known to man. I love this track. Me and my wife just go crazy for this track. It's just the wordplay is so dumb and yet so profound.
The Muffin Man is seated at the table in the laboratory of the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen. Reaching for an oversized chrome spoon, he gathers an intimate quantity of dried muffin remnants and, brushing his scapular aside, proceeds to dump these inside of his shirt. He turns to us and speaks. Some people like cupcakes better. I, for one, care less for them. Arrogantly twisting the sterile canvas snoot of a fully charged icing anointment utensil, he puts forth a quarter-ounce green rosette. Let's try that again. He puts forth a quarter-ounce green rosette near the summit of a dense but radiant muffin of his own design. Later, he says, Some people... like cupcakes exclusively, while myself, I say, there is naught, nor ought there be, nothing so exalted on the face of God's gray earth as that prince of foods, the muffin. Girl, you thought it was a man, but it was a muffin. He hung around till you found that he didn't know nothing. Was a man, but he only was a puffin. No cries was heard in the night as a result of him stuffing. We'll be right back.
Bruce Fowler on trombone, Napoleon Murphy Brock on tenor sax and lead vocals, Terry Bozio on drums, Tom Fowler on bass, Denny Wally on slide, George Duke on keyboards, Captain Beefheart on vocals and soprano sax and madness. Thank you very much for coming to the concert tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. Good night, Austin, Texas, wherever you are.
So Shazad, maybe we should talk a little bit about Frank Zappa, because we had to stop ourselves from trading off into fanboy territory there, because we're both huge fans of Zappa and Captain Beefheart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I just love that track because it's so, you know, it's a borderline commercial hit. Mm. And yet, you know, as we were saying off air, you know, Zappa's so musically literate that he... that maybe that Brechtian wake-up call comes in again, because just when you're getting into it, he sidesteps it or plays something dissonant. It's just so, you know, he was almost too intelligent for his métier. And I kind of really relish that. And Beefheart, you know, as I was saying to you, I was just really sad when Don Van Vliet passed away, because I'd always had this closet dream to kind of, you know, my friend Martin Sexton knew him, and I'd always had this closet dream to go out and make a kind of poetic kind of documentary film about him. And, you know, I think he was just a really, I mean, what he did with music was really so significant. I think you, what were you saying?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying my favourite album of his is Trautmann's Replica. And I was saying that I always see that as like, the moment of high modernism in music, or the kind of the zero point of structure, really, where musicians can't really go beyond that. That was popular music abstracted to the nth degree. And so for me, as somebody who plays music, there's so much in that record. It's almost like, there's just so many ideas, and the virtuosity of the players is incredible. Like, I saw the band play recently with one of the guys from the Captain Beefheart band was doing the vocals, and it's astonishing. They play note for note. It's incredible, really, really incredible.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, both Beefheart and Zappa were incredibly precise musicians. Mm. And I think particularly with Zappa, that allowed him to roam all over the place and do some, you know, really ridiculous stuff. I mean, you know, if you think of Reuben and the Jets.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Which is just almost pure comedy.
Yeah.
It's, you know, but, you know, to be able to kind of move between pastiche and various other things, you know, it, just that virtuosity is really present. But, you know, thinking about it, talking about a kind of certain modernism in music, you know, there's such a kind of fetish in the art world for, like, say, Kraftwerk and European electronica.
Yeah, I know.
And you think, you know, I actually think it's kind of rather derivative. Mm. And I think maybe in that way, maybe we haven't broken the monoculture, because that's why I wanted to start with Dr. Agamantado, because I think that period in, say, Jamaican music, what Lee Scratch Perry and King Tubby and others were doing is actually far more radical. Mm. So I think that's where I want to sort of put that out there, that, you know, perhaps even, you know, yeah, well, perhaps there's certain aspects in which we are still very much operating in a monoculture.
And also, I think there's like a, well, it's a kind of minimalist sensibility, I think, that still pervades a lot in contemporary art. And it's kind of this kind of, I think the clinical aesthetic of Kraftwerk appeals to that sensibility in a way. But what I really like Kraftwerk is when they're out of context. Or what happens when their music got taken out of context, which was African Bambaataa and all the stuff that happened in Detroit. And there was an MP3 that...
I was going to come on to Detroit, because I think that's the other high point for me of electronic music.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
But sorry, go ahead.
No, it was just someone had an MP3 of the concert that Kraftwerk gave in Detroit. And it would be good to A and B those, to compare that audience to the audience at the Tate, at the Turbine Hall, because... it was incredible, the atmosphere in Detroit. It was like gods had appeared for them, that people were just cheering and screaming. Yeah, it was amazing. But anyway, we should get back onto your work, because that's what we're here, that's what we're talking about. But I suppose one of the things that Zappa shares with you is this passion for collaboration and pulling people from different worlds and disciplines and creating one sort of work. And for me, that's what Feature was, maybe one of your first examples of that happening on a large scale. So 10 minutes shy of official Feature time at 55 minutes. But how did you approach this? Especially because you were working with Jimmy Durham and David Medalla, who was amazing. I tell you what, could you give us like a summary of what the project was? Just a kind of plot summary of Feature.
I guess there's so many potted summaries of it out there.
I
don't want to wade in.
I know, you don't. Yeah.
You know, I think maybe the more honest thing to say is that I think it came about at a point in my career where I just thought, you know what? I really just want to pull out the stops. Mm. I just thought, I was just kind of, I'd had enough of playing small or following this little path or that little path. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to take off the brakes, throw everything out, and just actually stand up for everything I'd really like to do in, I think, a way I'd never had quite the courage or the confidence to do before that. And what was kind of wonderful and kind of liberating and also shocking about the whole thing is that, you know, I just thought, I'm going to do this. And I remember psyching myself up and pitching this film to people, fully expecting that somehow if I laid it all out there, people would go, are you crazy? You want money for what? But what was mad was that everyone said, that sounds great. Can we sign up? And it suddenly, I had to make this thing, this crazy, unwieldy thing that, you know, at the kind of top of the stratosphere, the kind of ultimate metatext was it was about, for me, Feature was about Samuel Beckett and Buster Keaton's relationship during the making of film. Mm. And, you know, they're two of my heroes in another field. I have many heroes or anti-heroes or semi-heroes. And, you know, both, and Beckett and Keaton didn't get on at all. When Beckett first went to meet Buster Keaton, who by this time was a bit washed up and, you know, he was watching the World Series of baseball and he just told Beckett to help himself to a beer from the fridge and then ignored him the whole time he was there. And then Keaton really kind of got frustrated with Beckett because Beckett would, because film was this very conceptual piece about the all-seeing eye.
Yeah.
And so he keeps stopping. Keaton felt that Beckett kept stopping him before he'd do his gag, you know, before he'd do his do the punchline. And I love this idea of that, you know, these two kind of giants of 20th century kind of these arts and letters are just there kind of, you know, just, can I say fucking with each other on air?
Well, you have.
Oh, dear. Okay. But they're just, you know, they're just, you know, it's that sort of thing where, you know, you shouldn't meet your heroes.
Yeah.
You know.
But also, just to, aside from it being this kind of homage to that situation or reference to that situation, I'm going to give a plot summary. I'm going to try, attempt a plot summary. So basically, Feature is a kind of zombie Western. Yeah. Let's say it's a Western in which the character of Lord Krishna rides into town. And town is a kind of frontier town space, which is actually in a place called Wising, which is in the countryside. So he rides into town, but and also, is it Chief Sitting Bull?
Jimmy Durham plays Sitting Bull, which is interesting because he only ever appears seated in a chair.
That's right, as a kind of narrator.
As a narrator. Yeah, yeah. So there's, you know, it's just very, very, it's both dense and playful, and there's various things going on. I think, you know, Wising, it should be pointed out, is in Cambridgeshire.
Yeah.
And I kind of purposely chose it because it's about as flat as you can get. So it's kind of the opposite of the kind of mesas and things of the Wild West.
Yeah.
And then I brought in kind of cinema painters from Pakistan to paint huge Rocky Mountain backdrops, which were erected on stilts in the landscape. And so it's, you know, this whole idea of artifice, you know, it makes a jump from, say, the Antonioni blow-up hoax to this next kind of even more absurd, you know, absurd potpourri of different elements.
And it's great because the film, it kind of contains a lot of characters and references that appear in different works. So, I mean, Lord Krishna is kind of a reoccurring character in a lot of your pieces, right? And I mean, so he first appears in Sunday Morning, which is a film piece in 2001 where Krishna leaves his house, goes to the pub and meets Rama, and they're kind of having this lad chat about, women. And Rama's saying, oh, you've got like hundreds of wives and I'm just stuck with Sita. So, can you tell, what is the significance? How come do you keep returning to Krishna?
I've just been fascinated. Krishna is, you know, an avatar of Vishnu, right. Who's one of the kind of the Hindu sort of trinity. Mm. And
could you explain that? Because Hindu trinity?
Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma are the sort of Hindu trinity at the sort of top of the pantheon, and then there are lesser gods and there are avatars who are kind of each of those three main gods reoccurring in different forms. And I love that kind of the kind of rich cosmology. You know, it's like the opposite end of the spectrum to say Martin Luther.
Yeah.
And particularly, I guess, on a personal note, I grew up with these comic books that were published by a company called Amar Chitra Kata, and they were like, you know, they were actually in the English language, but published out of India, but of, you know, tales of Krishna and other gods and, you know, even about Islam and Sikhism and things like that. So it was kind of the kind of whole melting pot that is India in terms of different belief systems and cultural and religious narratives. Mm. But, you know, particularly the stories of Krishna always fascinated me because he was this kind of trickster, this really cheeky but wonderful guy who got away with stuff, but was also always there to save the day, and you know, had all these, you know, chased the gopis, who are these sort of women who kind of tend the cows, and you know, he's and he plays his flute, and it has this sort of magical effect. He can multiply himself. He's just the most fantastic figure, and. You know, I've always just been very attracted to the figure of Krishna, and I also think it kind of appears in other, you know, in other cultural constructs. So, for example, coyote in Native American mythology is not too far from Krishna, and various other people. You know, there's lots of writings on trickster that make links between these different figures.
So, I mean, and in Mystery Play is, I guess, your second film after, well, not feature, but yeah, second kind of piece after. Feature, and is that Krishna feature in that as well? Is it?
It's kind of, it looks like the same character, but it's black and white. So it was really, you know, the sort of Billy the Krishna character and feature is a sort of an amalgam of Billy the Kid and Krishna of Hindu mythology. But for me, that was also the kind of homage to Buster Keaton, because you know, there's a certain thing in the kind of, although he's blue, the eye makeup, the kind of the costume is very reminiscent of Keaton in The General.
And it occurred to me when I was watching this that the reason I said mage at the beginning was because it seemed to me that what you were doing wasn't just a kind of riff on multiculturalism at all, or just like this kind of random juxtaposition of different cultures. It was a kind of alchemy, and it feels to me that you were moving towards this kind of mystical intermingling of.
I think it's always been there, and I think maybe that goes back to this idea of, you know, the early work sort of forming an apprenticeship, exploring kind of signs and meanings more in the kind of surface level of culture and media, and then sort of wanting to go deeper and deeper into the sort of substructure behind those signs and the kind of almost the kind of hidden codings that go behind not just advertising or commercial photography, but to go into the structures that lie behind meanings, signs, beliefs, and to really kind of penetrate to something kind of deeper. So yes, there's very much a kind of growing kind of grappling with alchemy, with ideas of magic, how that operates, and starting to understand a kind of a fluid relationship between, say, cinema and believed other beliefs and belief structures that might relate to kind of occultism. Mm. I think there's a really interesting slipstream between cinema and occultism.
Yeah, because I saw when I came to visit you at the studio, you had that book, the three books of who was it by again?
Oh, Agrippa.
That's it. Yeah.
Sort of classic of Western occultism, yeah, yeah.
And it reminded me of, there's a film called The Mindscape of Alan Moore. And so Alan Moore is obviously our most famous wizard at the moment. But
Grant Morrison, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, this... Alan Moore is putting it out there. I mean, he's going to published a grimoire in the form of this comic. I can't remember the title of it, but I can send it to you. I've got it. Well, I shouldn't say that on air, but I can send it to you digitally. But he was sort of likening art to magic, really, and he used the example of satire, and that if you weave a satire about somebody, that can ruin their lives, and it becomes like a spell. It becomes like this thing that.
Yeah, I think, it's not just art is magic. Everything is magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the degree to which we take electricity for granted.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, yeah. So what we're going to talk about now, from that to some more, hypnotism, I guess, or hypnagogic encounters with the New Dream Machine Project.
Okay. So I see where you're going with
this. Yeah, that other link there. But I just want to, you know what, I think we should play one of the excerpts. So for this project, you sort of restaged... Or could you talk us through the project?
Yeah, if you want. Yeah, I thought you were doing fine.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult because it's hard to navigate some of your projects because there's so many things happening. You don't make it easy for us interpreters. But, so what's happening is the New Dream Machine project is centred around this scaled-up version of Brian Geisen's Dream Machine, which is kind of like a rotating sphere...
Cylinder,
that's right, with holes in it, kind of like a zoetrope with a glass in the middle, but you're supposed to close your eyes and let the kind of the flicker sort of seep into you and pushes you into a kind of dreamlike state. But there were all these different diverse narrative strands around it. There was this idea that Geisen brought Brian Jones to Morocco and Brian Jones recorded these musicians, the Djajouka musicians, and then you restaged that with the master musicians of Djajouka and Chute Garwood, got them to play the concert and filmed it in the Cinematheque in Tangiers.
That's a pretty good summing up, Morgan.
Well, before we talk about it, we're going to play... This is an excerpt of... Is this the live recording from...
Yes, it
okay.
is.
So when the filming of this was, you used 16mm, which was, I guess, different from feature and mystery play. Were you using
HD? No, mystery play was 16.
Oh, it was?
Super 16, and feature was a mixture of HD and Super 16. So I'm kind of interested even, I'm not a pure fetishist for 16.
Yeah.
I'm quite interested in using what's appropriate for the project, and particularly for the sort of longer durational films like feature or the most recent Piercing Brightness, to kind of really hybridize different formats and you know, image making methodologies.
Because I was thinking, well, is this, were you using it because it, you say you're using it to suit the form or to suit the content? Mm. And this, I think we were saying earlier, but it reminded me of Woodstock, and you were saying actually no.
That, actually, that, what I was thinking of more was D.A. Pennebaker's Monterey Pop, which I think is a really amazing filmic artifact. You know, it's both really watchable, and yet he's doing some really interesting experimental things that, you know, that echo what a lot of structuralist filmmakers were working on at the time. And, you know, I'm always sort of getting into trouble for, because I'm always saying things like that, which are perhaps not so orthodox, but I think I quite like artifacts that kind of don't conform to one dogma or another. That's maybe my reading, but Monterey Pop, I think, is just a great. It's just a really great music film. It's one of my favourites.
And what was it like redoing this project? Because it seemed like, again, this process of alchemy where you're pulling lots of different things together and intermingling them, and then creating this experience around the Dream Machine. What was it like on the evening? Because there's moments where you see the crowd and they're kind of in these trance-like states, ecstatic states.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was very mesmeric. Mm. You know, I'd purposely not introduced Duke Garwood to the master musicians till the night before the gig.
Really?
Yeah, because I wanted to just, you know, there's always comes a point where you might do all the preparation, but you need to kind of pull the rug out in some one way or another to keep it fresh, to bring it, to make it vital. So as much as we were kind of invoking or evoking a kind of ghost of guys in Brian Jones, which, you know, has a certain magical function of its own, it needed to be also live and present in the present moment. You know, I'm really interested in kind of negotiating narratives and histories, but if you don't make them alive in the present, it hasn't got that magic, perhaps, that is essential to the functioning of the artist.
And are you also talking to me before about this, your interest in capturing performance or performance within performance? And I think we were talking about the Yardbirds
in Blow Up,
and also the Strawberry
Alarm Clock in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the Russ Meyer film.
Yeah,
and I love, you know, I love those two films because I love that idea of a band, you know, playing live or appearing to play live, sort of inserted into the middle of a feature film. I love that idea that the sort of gig erupts. And, you know, it's something I've tried to do, say, in feature. You have the Lonesome Cowboys from Hell performing live.
Oh, yeah, the postmodern blues.
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
You know, with Rosie Cooper kind of doing a kind of burlesque to accompany them. And it's bringing together, you know, really important kind of artists with their own, and allowing their discourse to kind of flow into yours. I love that kind of circulation of ideas. And, you know, you talked about that in Zappa earlier, and I think, say, in Piercing Brightness, the most recent film project, we had Alexander Tucker and his Decompressed Orchestra performing live in what is a kind of very key hinge moment in the film, where a kind of different reality is kind of evidenced.
So Piercing Brightness, I should say, for people, is a kind of aliens coming to Earth sort of sci-fi narrative, in where you have a colony or a group of extraterrestrials known as the 100. Is that right? And they come to the UK, they come to Preston.
Of course.
Yeah, naturally. To kind of help mankind, and then what we see is that the film kind of plays out a set of events that are happening leading up to them going back to where they came from, and it involves I guess these two aliens who return to Earth and get drunk and experience what it's like, and then these guys on BMXs in hoodies who. I wanted to ask because there's a moment in it where they talk about a mutation, changing forms. And I wondered, are the guys in hoodies representative of that state where people have changed too much and they've become like the birds? Because there's...
I think, you know, for me, and I've talked about this quite a lot with my friend Mark Bartlett, who's a film theorist. And for me, I think the hoodies represent the hybrid possibility, you know, where you become neither one thing nor another. Mm-hmm. Which is both perhaps, you know, a next step in our evolution as a species, where, you know, we start to
maybe relax and let go of some of our identity, which is already happening, but, you know, without needing to clamp onto something else, which is such a sort of human, you know, control mechanism. But I also wanted to look at some of the pitfalls of being stuck in that position where you're neither here nor there.
Yeah.
And so they almost, they're the kind of tragedy of the film, I think, because they don't make it onto the spaceship and yet they don't quite fit in.
No. And I mean, I suppose there's an impulse in a way to read it as a narrative that's about or a metaphor for the immigrant experience. Was that something that...
It could be read as that, but I think also could be read as the, you know, as in some ways for me, a lot of the structure was based upon, you know, the Bardo, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and equally, you know, certain parallels with the Egyptian Book of the Dead and this idea of the soul's journey after death. But, you know, I was just very interested in researching, say, Preston, like when I make films places, it's generally after a number of years of research and spending time and interviewing people, so they really don't, you know, they don't come up overnight. And you know, one of the reasons for this possible fact that, you know, the aliens who've been on Earth for millennia have all ended up in Preston, you know, seem to kind of really gel with some of the kind of factual evidence there that, you know, in the research process of the film, it turned out that Lancashire has one of the highest UFO sighting rates in the UK. Preston has the fastest growing mainland Chinese population in the UK, and it also is the birthplace of Mormonism. You know, all things that seem actually very pertinent to the current moment and certain ideas that are in circulation. So that was kind of, you know, my in to start to articulate or weave a web of narrative or narratives, plural, around these kind of quite salient facts.
Yeah, because I have to say, sometimes when you read what people write about your work, I mean, I think they kind of lean on the kind of multicultural discourse as a kind of crux, because they're uncomfortable with just talking about the film as it is. But yeah, I can definitely sense what you're saying in the piece, and
I mean, you know, it's always that thing where I have to kind of, you know, smile or wince at people needing to kind of, you know, reduce my work to multiculturalism. Whereas, I mean, if that it does occur there, it's a kind of, it's either a red herring or it's
absolutely,
it's not really multiculturalism. It's just things as they are. You know, it's like the opposite of the whitewash that was Notting Hill.
All right, yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was
thinking. It's trying to look at the world as I find it. And also as it might be. And as it perhaps may be. And I think it's those possible futures that made me very interested in sort of science fiction as a narrative. You know, I'm very interested in the way in which, say, a lot of the ideas from pulp science fiction of the 70s relating to sort of parallel dimensions or parallel universes starts to map out in more recent, you know, theories in quantum mechanics proper.
Yeah.
You know, that say in the works of Hawking and Penrose is this, you know, it's just like, huh?
I know.
This sounds like the stuff I was reading, you know, after Lights Out, you know, when I was a kid.
I mean, a friend of mine's brother is a physics professor at Cambridge. And it's just some of the things that they talk about are just so fantastical. It's like you're involved.
Or fanboyish.
So can we talk about what you're sort of planning to do in the future now? Because I know you're working on a curatorial project with the Devi Foundation. Is it titled Black Sun? Is that
I'm working on that with the Devi Foundation and with Tom Trevor from Arnold Feeney. And it's a show called Black Sun. And I think the kind of current working title is Alchemy, Diaspora, and hybrid utopias. And looking at and it's quite nice, actually. I haven't curated in a few years, so it was quite nice to kind of come back to curating, because every once in a while you want it to not be about your own work, and it was quite nice to kind of map out some of your intellectual pursuits through a narrative around other artists' work, and then to kind of bring in some of the kind of free association that, you know, that I play with, but be able to articulate it through a kind of wider set of practices.
Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately, because we need to play out with a piece of music by Acid Mother's Temple, which is from the feature movie.
Actually, Acid Mother's Temple did do the soundtrack for Piercing Brightness, which is due out later this year, which is a science fiction film we've been talking about. But the piece I chose to play out with
by Acid Mothers, which you can announce in a second,
yeah.
is something I'm looking at incorporating into a new video work, which might see the light of day in the next year or two or three.
See, I'm kicking myself that we've... It's always the way I run. Just as I find a new topic I want to, you know, talk, tease out of you, we've run out of time. But Shazad, I just want to say thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to have you sitting across to me tonight in Studio Visit. Thank you for coming.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Morgan. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And tune in next week where I'll be talking to Thick Ear, which is a sound art collective featuring, I guess, about 7 or 8 sound artists. So cacophony will be the topic. Thank you very much and good night.